was beginning to fall apart. In this grim grey London, the drunkard's body hadn't lasted long at all, much to the displeasure of the thing burning its way through him. It wasn't the magic's fault. There was so little to hold on to here, so little to feed on. The people had only a candle's light of life inside them, not the fire to which the darkness was accustomed. So little heat, so easily extinguished. The moment he got inside, he burned them up to nothing, blood and bone to husk and dash, in no time at all. Booth's black eyes drifted down to his charred fingers. With such poor kindling, he couldn't seem to spread, couldn't last long in anybody. Not for lack of trying. After all, he'd left a trail of discarded shells along the docks. Burned through the place they all called Southwark in a mere hour. But his current body, the one he'd taken in the tavern alley, was now coming undone. The black stain across his shirt front pulsed, trying to keep the last of the life from bleeding out. Perhaps he shouldn't have stabbed the drunkard first, but it seemed the fastest way in. But the failing shell and the lack of prospects had left him with a predicament. He appeared to be rotting. Bits of skin flaked off with every step. The people in the street looked at him and moved away, out of reach, as if whatever was eating him was contagious. Which, of course, it was. Magic was a truly beautiful disease, but only when the hosts were strong enough, pure enough. The people here were not. He walked on through the city, shuffled, hobbled, really, at this point. The power in this shell only embers now and quickly cooling. And in his desperation he found himself drawn on, drawn back to the place where he had started, the stone's throw. He wondered at the pull of the odd little tavern. It was a flicker of warmth in the cold, dead city, a glimmer of light, of life, of magic. If he could get there, he might find a fire yet. He was so consumed by the need to reach the tavern that he did not notice the man standing by its door, nor the carriage fast approaching as he stepped off the curb and into the street. Edward Archibald Tuttle stood outside the stone's throw, frowning at the time. It should be open by now, but the bolts were still thrown, the window shuttered, and everything within seemed strangely still. He checked his pocket watch. It was after noon. How odd. Suspicious, he thought. Nefarious, even. His mind spun over the possibilities, all of them dark. His family insisted that he had too vivid an imagination, but he held that the rest of the world simply lacked the sight, the sense for magic, which he obviously possessed. Or at least endeavoured to possess. Or truly had begun to fear he would never possess. Had begun to think, though he would not admit it, did not exist. Until he found the traveller, the renowned magician known only as Kell. That single and singular meeting had rekindled his belief, stoked the fires hotter than they had ever been. And so Edward had done as he was told and returned to the stone's throw in hopes of finding the magician a second time and receiving his promised bag of earth. To that end, he had come yesterday, and to that end he would come again tomorrow, and the next, until the illustrious figure returned. While he waited, Ned, for that was what his friends and family called him, spun stories in his head, trying to imagine how the eventual meeting would take shape, how it would unfold. The details changed, but the end remained the same. In every version, the magician Kell would tip his head and consider Ned with his black eye. "Edward Archibald Tuttle," he'd say, "may I call you Ned? All my friends do. Well, Ned, I see something special in you." He'd then insist upon being Ned's mentor, or even better, his partner. After that, the fantasy usually devolved into praise. Ned had been playing out yet another of these daydreams while he stood on the steps of the stone's throw waiting. His pockets were weighted with trinkets and coins, anything the magician might want in exchange for his prize. But the magician had not come, and the tavern was all locked up, and Ned, after whispering something that was equal parts spell and prayer and nonsense, and trying unsuccessfully to will the bolt from its place, was about to pause his pursuit for the moment and go pass a few hours in an open establishment, when he heard a crash behind him in the street. Horses whinnied and wheels clattered to a halt, several crates of apples tumbling out of a cart as the driver pulled back sharply on the reins. He looked more frightened than his horses. "What's the matter?" asked Ned, striding over. "Bloody hell!" the driver was saying. "I've hit him! I've hit someone!" Ned looked around. "I don't think you've hit anything." "Is he under the cart?" went on the driver. "Oh, God, I didn't see him!" But when he knelt to inspect the space beneath the carriage, the spokes of its wheels, Ned saw nothing but a stretch of soot. It was, strangely enough, vaguely person-shaped, across the stones, already blowing away. One small mound seemed to move, but then it crumbled inward and was gone. Strange, he thought with a frown. Ominous. He held his breath and reached out toward the smear of charcoal dust, expecting it to spring to life. His fingers met the ash and nothing happened. He rubbed the soot between his thumb and forefinger, disappointed. "Nothing there, sir," he said, getting to his feet.
"I swear," said the driver, "there was someone here. Right here."
"Must have been mistaken." The driver shook his head, mumbling, then climbed down from the cart and reloaded the crates, looking under the cart a few more times just in case. Ned held his fingers up to the light, wondering at the soot. He had felt something, or thought he had, a prickle of warmth. But the feeling had quickly faded to nothing. He sniffed the soot once and sneezed roundly, then wiped the ash on his pant leg, and wandered off down the street. 2. Kell and Lila made their way to the docks, invisible to passers-by. But not only invisible, intangible. Just as the ash had passed through them at the ruined inn and Kell's hand through Lila's shoulder, so did the people on the street. They could neither feel nor hear them. It was as if, beneath the veil, Kell and Lila were not part of the world around them, as if they existed outside of it. And just as the world could not touch them, they could not touch the world. When Lila absently tried to pocket an apple from a cart, her hand went through the fruit as sure as the fruit went through her hand. They were as ghosts in the bustling city. This was strong magic, even in a London rich with power. The stone's energy thrummed through Kell, twining with his own like a second pulse. A voice in the back of his head warned him against the thing coursing through his body, but he pushed the voice away. For the first time since he'd been wounded, Kell didn't feel dizzy and weak, and he clung to the strength as much as to the stone itself as he led Lila toward the docks. She'd been quiet since they left the remains of the inn, holding on to Kell with one hand and the timepiece with the other. When she finally spoke, her voice was low and sharp.
"Before you go thinking Baron and I were blood, we weren't," she said as they walked side by side. "It wasn't my family. Not really."
The words rang stiff and hollow, and the way she clenched her jaw and rubbed her eyes, when she thought he wasn't looking, told another story. But Kell let Lila keep her lie. "Do you have any?" he asked, remembering her biting remarks about his situation with the crown. "Family, that is?"
Lila shook her head. "Mum's been dead since I was 10."
"No father?"
Lila gave a humorless laugh. "My father," she said it like it was a bad word. "The last time I saw him, he tried to sell my flesh to pay his tab."
"I'm sorry," said Kell.
"Don't be," said Lila, managing the sharp edge of a smile. "I cut the man's throat before he could get his belt off."
Kell tensed.
"I was 15, she went on casually. "I remember wondering at the amount of blood, the way it kept spilling out of him."
"First time you killed someone?" asked Kell.
"Indeed," she said, her smile turning rueful. "But I suppose the nice thing about killing is that it gets easier."
Kell's brow furrowed. "It shouldn't."
Lila's eyes flicked up to his. "Have you ever killed anyone?" she asked.
Kell's frown deepened. "Yes."
"And?"
"And what?" he challenged. He expected her to ask who or where or when and how. But she didn't. She asked why. "Because I had no choice," he said.
"Did you enjoy it?"
she asked. "Of course not."
"I did."
There was a streak of bitterness woven through the admission.
"I mean, I didn't enjoy the blood or the gurgling sound he made as he died, or the way the body looked when it was over. Empty. But the moment I decided to do it, and the moment after that when the knife bit in and I knew that I'd done it, I felt..."
Lila searched for the words.
"Powerful."
She considered Kell then.
"Is that what magic feels like?"
she asked honestly. Maybe in White London, thought Kell, where power was held like a knife, a weapon to be used against those in your way. "No," he said. "That's not magic, Lila, that's just murder. Magic is..." But he trailed off, distracted by the nearest scrying board, which had suddenly gone dark. Up and down the streets, the black notice boards affixed to lamp posts and storefronts went blank. Kell slowed. All morning there had been running notices of Rye's celebrations, a cycling itinerary of the days and weeks, parades and public feasts, festivals and private dances. When the boards first went dark, Kell assumed that they were simply changing over stories, but then they all began to flash the same alarming message. A single word. Missing. The letters flashed bold and white at the top of every board, and beneath it, a picture of Kell. Red hair and black eye and silver-buttoned coat. The image moved faintly but didn't smile, only stared out at the world. A second word wrote itself beneath the portrait. Reward. Sankt. Kell slammed to a stop, and Lila, who'd been half a step behind, ran into him.
"What's the matter?"
she asked, pushing off his arm, and then she saw it too.
"Oh."
An old man stopped a few feet away to read the board, oblivious to the fact that the missing man stood just behind his shoulder. Beneath the wavering image of Kell's face, an empty circle drew itself in chalk. The instructions beside it read, "If seen... touch here." Kell swore under his breath. Being hunted by Holland was bad enough, but now the whole city would be on alert. And they couldn't stay invisible forever. He wouldn't be able to lift a token, let alone use it, as long as they were under the veil. "Come on." He picked up his pace, dragging Lila with him until they reached the docks. All around, his face stared back at them, frowning slightly. When they reached Fletcher's shop, the door was shut and locked, a small sign hanging on its front that read, "Renache. Away."
"Do we wait?" asked Lila.
"Not out here," said Kell. The door was bolted three ways, and likely charmed as well, but they didn't need to be let in. They passed straight through the wood, the way they had half a dozen people on the street. Only once they were safe within the shop did Kell will the magic to release the veil. Again it listened and obeyed without protest, the magic thinning and then dissolving entirely. "Conviction," he mused, as the spell slid from his shoulders, the room coming into sharper focus around him. Holland had been right. It was about staying in control. And Kell had. Lila let go of his hand and turned back to face him. She froze.
"Kell?"
she said carefully.
"What is it?" he asked.
"Put down the stone."
He frowned, looked down at the talisman in his grip and caught his breath. The veins on the back of his hand were dark, so dark that they stood out like ink against his flesh, the lines tracing up toward his elbow. The power he felt pulsing through him was actually pulsing through him, turning his blood black. He had been so focused on his renewed strength and on the spell itself, on staying hidden, that he had not felt, had not wanted to feel the warmth of the magic spreading up his arm like poison. But he should have noticed, should have known, that was the thing. Kell knew better. He knew how dangerous the stone was, and yet, even now, staring down at his darkened veins, that danger felt strangely far away. A persistent calm pressed through him stride for stride with the stone's magic, telling him that everything would be all right, so long as he kept holding. A knife buried itself in the post beside his head and the room snapped back into focus.
"Have you gone deaf?"
growled Lila, freeing another blade.
"I said, put it down."
Before the calm could close over him again, Kell willed himself to release the stone. At first his fingers stayed clasped around the talisman as warmth, and in its wake a kind of numbness seeped through him. He brought his free, untainted hand to his darkening wrist and gripped hard, willing his resistant fingers to uncurl, to release the stone. And finally, reluctantly, they did. The stone tumbled from his grip, and Kell's knee instantly buckled beneath him. He caught himself on a table's edge, gasping for breath as his vision swam and the room tilted. He hadn't felt the stone leeching his energy, but now that it was gone, it was like someone had doused his fire. Everything went cold. The talisman glinted on the wooden floor, a streak of blood against the jagged edge where Kell had gripped too hard. Even in its wake, it took all Kell's will not to take it up again. Shaking and chilled, he still longed to hold it. There were men who lurked in dens and in the dark corners of London chasing highs like this, but Kell had never been one of them, never craved the raw power, never needed to. Magic wasn't something he lusted for. It was something he simply had. But now his veins felt starved of it, and starving for it. Before he could lose battle for control, Lila knelt beside the stone.
"Clever little thing," she said, reaching for it.
"Don't," started Kell, but she had already used her handkerchief to sweep it up.
"Someone's got to hold on to it,"
she said, slipping the talisman into her pocket.
"And I'd wager I'm the better choice right now."
Kell clutched the table as the magic withdrew, the veins in his arm lightening little by little.
"Still with us?" asked Lila.
Kell swallowed and nodded. The stone was a poison, and they had to be rid of it. He steadied himself.
"I'm all right."
Lila raised a brow.
"Yes, you are the very image of health."
Kell sighed and slumped into a chair. On the docks outside, the celebrations were in full swing. Fireworks punctuated the music and cheers, the noise dulled but not much by the walls of the shop.
"What's he like?"
asked Lila, looking in a cabinet.
"The prince."
"Rye." Kell ran a hand through his hair.
"He's charming and spoiled. Generous and fickle and hedonistic. He would flirt with a nicely upholstered chair, and he never takes anything seriously."
"Does he get into as much trouble as you do?"
Kell cracked a smile.
"Oh, much more. Believe it or not, I'm the responsible one."
"But you two are close."
Kell's smile fell, and he nodded once.
"Yes.
The king and queen may not be my parents, but Rai is my brother. I would die for him. I would kill for him. And I have."
"Oh?" asked Lila, admiring her hat. "Do tell."
"It's not a pleasant story," said Kell, sitting forward.
"Now I want to hear it even more," said Lila.
Kell considered her and sighed, looking down at his hands. "When Rai was 13, he was abducted. We were playing some stupid game in the palace courtyard when he was taken. Though, knowing Rai, he might have gone willingly at first. Growing up, he was always too trusting."
Lila set the hat aside. "What happened?"
"Red London is a good place," insisted Kell. "The royals here are kind and just, and most of the subjects are happy. But," he continued, "I have been to all three Londons, and I can say this. There is no version that does not suffer in one way or another." He thought of the opulence, the glittering wealth, and what it must look like to those without. Those who had been stripped of power for crimes, and those never blessed with much to begin with. Kell could not help wondering, what would have become of Rai Maresh if he were not a royal? Where would he be? But of course Rai could survive on his charm and his smile. He would always get by. "My world is a world made of magic," he said. "The gifted reap the blessings, and the royal family wants to believe that those who are not gifted do as well, that their generosity and their care extend to every citizen." He found Lila's eyes. "But I have seen the darker parts of this city. In your world, magic is a rarity. In mine, the lack of it is just as strange. And those without gifts are often looked down upon as unworthy of them and treated as less for it. The people here believe that magic chooses its path, that it judges, and so can they. Aven Essen, they call it. Divine balance." But by that logic, the magic had chosen Kell, and he did not believe that. Someone else could just have easily woken or been born with the Antari mark and been brought into the lush red folds of the palace in his stead. "We live brightly," said Kell. "For better or worse, our city burns with life. With light. And where there's light, well..." "Several years ago, a group began to form. They called themselves the Shadows. Half a dozen men and women, some with power, some without, who believed the city burned its power too brightly and with too little care, squandering it. To them, Rai was not a boy, but a symbol of everything wrong, and so they took him. I later learned they meant to hang his body from the palace doors. Saints be thanked, they never got the chance. I was 14 when it happened, a year Rai's senior, and still coming into my power. When the king and queen learned of their son's abduction, they sent the royal guard across the city. Every scrying board in every public square and private home burned with the urgent message to find the stolen prince. And I knew they would not find him. I knew it in my bones and in my blood. I went to Rai's rooms. I remember how empty the palace was with all the guards out searching, and found the first thing I knew was truly his, a small wooden horse he'd carved, no bigger than a palm. I had made doors, using tokens before, but never one like this, never to a person instead of a place. But there is an Antari word for find, and so I thought it would work. It had to. And it did. The wall of his room gave way to the bottom of a boat. Rai was lying on the floor, and he wasn't breathing. Air hissed between Lila's teeth, but she didn't interrupt. I had learned the blood commands for many things, said Kell. As Athira, to grow. As Pirata, to burn. As Illumai, to light. As Travaz, to travel, as Orenta, to open, as Anasai, to dispel, as Hasarai, to heal. So I tried to heal him. I cupped my hand and pressed it to his chest and said the words. And it didn't work. Kel would never shake the image of Rai lying on the damp deck floor, pale and still. It was one of the only times in his life that he looked small. "I didn't know what to do," continued Kel. "I thought maybe I hadn't used enough blood, so I cut my wrists." He could feel Lila's unwavering stare as he looked down at his hands now, palms up, considering the ghosted scars. I remember kneeling over him, the dull ache spreading up my arms as I pressed my palms against him and said the words over and over and over. "As-Hasarai, As-Hasarai, As-Hasarai." What I didn't realize then was that a healing spell, even a blood command, takes time. It was already working. Had been since the first invocation. A few moments later, Rai woke up. Kel broke into a sad smile. He looked up and saw me crouching over him, bleeding, and the first thing he said wasn't what happened or where are we. He touched the blood on his chest and said, "Is it yours? Is it all yours?" And when I nodded, he burst into tears. But I took him home. When he found Lila's gaze, her dark eyes were wide.
"But what happened to the shadows?" she asked when it was clear that he was done. "The ones who took him? Were they in the boat? Did you go back for them? Did you send the guards?"
"Indeed," said Kel. "The king and queen tracked down every member of the shadows, and Rai pardoned them all."
"What?" gasped Lila. "After they tried to kill him?"
"That's the thing about my brother. He's headstrong and thinks with every part of his body but his brain most days, but he's a good prince. He possesses something many lack. Empathy. He forgave his captors. He understood why they did it, and he felt their suffering. And he was convinced that if he showed them mercy, they wouldn't try to harm him again." Kel's eyes went to the floor. "And I made sure they couldn't." Lila's brow crinkled as she realized what he was saying.
"I thought you said..."
"I said Rai forgave them," Kel pushed to his feet. "I never said I did." Lila stared at him, not with shock or horror, but a measure of respect. Kel rolled his shoulders and smoothed his coat. "I guess we better start looking." She blinked once, twice, obviously wanting to say more, but Kel made it as clear as he could that this particular discussion was over.
"What are we looking for?" she finally asked.
Kel surveyed the packed shelves, the overflowing cabinets and cupboards. "A white rook." 3. For all the digging he'd done through the ruins of the Ruby Fields, Kel had failed to notice the alley where he'd been attacked, and where he'd left two bodies behind only hours before. If he'd ventured there, he would have seen that one of those bodies, the cutthroat previously encased in stone, was missing. That same cutthroat now made his way down the curb, humming faintly as he relished the warmth of the sun and the far-off sounds of celebration. His body wasn't doing very well. Better than the other shell, of course, the drunkard in the duller London. That one hadn't lasted long at all. This one had fared better, much better, but now it was all burnt up inside and beginning to blacken without, the darkness spreading through its veins and over its skin like a stain. He looked less like a man now and more like a charred piece of wood. But that was to be expected. After all, he had been busy. The night before, the lights of the pleasure house had burned bright and luring in the dark, and a woman stood waiting for him in the doorway with a painted smile and hair the colour of fire, of life.
"Avendres Nasta,"
she purred in the smooth, Arnesian tongue. She drew up her skirts as she said it, flashing a glimpse of knee.
"Won't you come in?"
And he had, the cutthroat's coins jingling in his pocket. She led him down a hall. It was dark, much darker than it had been outside, and he'd let her lead, enjoying the feel of her hand, or, in truth, her pulse in his. She never looked him in the eyes, or she might have seen that they were darker than the hall around them. Instead, she focused on his lips, his collar, his belt. He was still learning the nuances of his new body, but he managed to press his cracking lips to the woman's soft mouth. Something passed between them, the ember of a pure black flame, and the woman shivered.
"As Besara," he whispered in her ear.
"Take." He slid the dress from her shoulders and kissed her deeper, his darkness passing over her tongue and through her head, intoxicating. Power. Everybody wanted it, wanted to be closer to magic, to its source. And she welcomed it. Welcomed him. Nerves tingled as the magic took them, feasting on a current of life, the blood, the body. He'd taken the drunkard Booth by force, but a willing host was always better. Or at least, they tended to last longer.
"As Helena," he cooed, pressing the woman's body back onto the bed.
"Give."
"As Athera," he moaned as he took her and she took him in.
"Grow." They moved together like a perfect pulse, one bleeding into the other. And when it was over and the woman's eyes floated open, they reflected his. Both a glossy black. The thing inside her skin pulled her rouged lips into a crooked smile.
"As Athera,"
she echoed, sliding up from the bed. He rose and followed, and they set out. One mind in two bodies. First through the pleasure house, and then through the night. Yes, he had been busy. He could feel himself spreading through the city as he made his way toward the waiting Red River. The pulse of magic and life laid out like a promised feast. 4. Fletcher's shop was built like a maze, arranged in a way that only the snake himself would understand. Kell had spent the last 10 minutes turning through drawers and had uncovered a variety of weapons and charms and a fairly innocuous parasol, but no white rook. He groaned and tossed the parasol aside.
"Can't you just find the damn thing using magic?"
asked Lila. "The whole place is warded," answered Kell. "Against locator spells. And against thieving, so put that back." Lila dropped the trinket she was about to palm back on the counter.
"So," she said, considering the contents of a glass case, "you and Fletcher are friends?"
Kell pictured Fletcher's face the night he'd lost the pot.
"Not exactly."
Lila raised a brow.
"Good," she said. "More fun to steal from enemies."
Enemies was a fair word. The strange thing was, they could have been partners. "A smuggler and a fence," he'd said. "We'd make a perfect team." "I'll pass," said Kell. But when the game of Sunk had been in its last hand and he'd known that he had won, he'd baited Fletcher with the one thing he wouldn't refuse.
"Anesh," he conceded. "If you win, I'll work for you."
Fletcher had smiled his greedy smile and drawn his last card, and Kell had smiled back and played his hand and won everything, leaving Fletcher with nothing more than a bruised ego and a small white rook. No hard feelings. Now Kell turned over half the store, searching for the token and glancing every few moments at the door while his own face watched them from the scrying board on the wall. missing.
Meanwhile, Lila had stopped searching and was staring at a framed map. She squinted and tilted her head, frowning as if something were amiss.
"What is it?"
asked Cal.
"Where's Paris?"
she asked, pointing to the place on the continent where it should be.
"There is no Paris," said Kel, rummaging through a cupboard. "No France. No England, either."
"But how can there be a London without an England?"
"I told you the city's a linguistic oddity. Here, London is the capital of Arn."
"So Arn is simply your name for England?"
Kel laughed.
"No,"
he said, shaking his head as he crossed to her side. "Arn covers more than half of your Europe. The island, your England, is called the Rasca, the Crown. But it's only the tip of the empire."
He traced the territory lines with his fingertip.
"Beyond our country lies Vesk to the north and Faro to the south."
"And beyond them?"
Kel shrugged.
"More countries. Some grand, some small. It's a whole world, after all."
Her gaze trailed over the map, eyes bright. A small private smile crossed her lips.
"Yes, it is."
She pulled away and wandered into another room.
And then moments later she called,
"Aha!"
Cal started.
"Did you find it?"
he called back. She reappeared, holding up her prize, but it wasn't the rook. It was a knife. Kel's spirit sank.
"No," she said, "but isn't this clever?"
She held it up for Kel to see. The hilt of the dagger wasn't simply a grip. The metal curved around over the knuckles in a wavering loop before rejoining the stock.
"For hitting,"
explained Lila, as if Kel couldn't grasp the meaning of the metal knuckles.
"You can stab them, or you can knock their teeth out,
or you could do both."
She touched the tip of the blade with her finger.
"Not at the same time, of course."
"Of course," echoed Kel, shutting a cabinet. "You're very fond of weapons."
Lila stared at him blankly.
"Who isn't?"
"But you already have a knife," he pointed out.
"So?"
asked Lila, admiring the grip.
"No such thing as too many knives."
"You're a violent sort."
She wagged the blade.
"We can't all turn blood and whispers into weapons."
Kel bristled.
"I don't whisper. And we're not here to loot."
"I thought that's exactly why we're here."
Kel sighed and continued to look around the shop. He turned over the whole thing, including Fletcher's cramped little room at the back, and come up empty. Fletcher wouldn't have sold it. Or would he? Kel closed his eyes, letting his senses wander, as if maybe he could feel the foreign magic. But the space was practically humming with power, overlapping tones that made it impossible to pass the foreign and forbidden from the merely forbidden.
"I've got a question,"
said Lila, her pockets jingling suspiciously.
"Of course you do,"
Kel sighed, opening his eyes.
"And I thought I said no thieving."
She chewed her lip and dug a few stones and a metal contraption even Kel didn't recognize the use of out of her pocket, setting them on a chest.
"You said the worlds were cut off. So how does this man, Fletcher, have a piece of white London?"
Kel sifted through a desk he swore he'd searched, then felt under the lip for hidden drawers.
"Because I gave it to him."
"Well, what were you doing with it?"
Her eyes narrowed.
"Did you steal it?"
Kel frowned. He had.
"No."
"Liar."
"I didn't take it for myself," said Kel. "Few people in your world know about mine. Those that do, collectors and enthusiasts, are willing to pay a precious sum for a piece of it. A trinket, a token. In my world, most know about yours. A few people are as intrigued by your mundaneness as you are by our magic. But everyone knows about the other
London, white London. And for a piece of that world, some would pay dearly. A wry smile cut across Lila's mouth.
"You're a smuggler,"
says the pickpocket,
snapped Kel defensively.
"I know I'm a thief,"
said Lila, lifting a red lin from the top of the chest and rolling it over her knuckles.
"I've accepted that. It's not my fault that you haven't."
The coin vanished. Kel opened his mouth to protest, but the lin reappeared an instant later in her other palm.
"I don't understand, though. If you're a royal..."
"I'm not,"
Lila gave him a withering look.
"If you live with royals and you dine with them and you belong to them, surely you don't want for money. Why risk it?"
Kel clenched his jaw, thinking of Rye's plea to stop his foolish games.
"You wouldn't understand."
Lila quirked a brow.
"Crime isn't that complicated,"
she said.
"People steal because taking something gives them something. If they're not in it for the money, they're in it for control. The act of taking, of breaking the rules, makes them feel powerful. They're in it for the sheer defiance."
She turned away. "Some people steal to stay alive, and some steal to feel alive. Simple as that."
"And which are you?" asked Kel.
"I steal for freedom," said Lila.
"I suppose that's a bit of both." She wandered into a short hallway between two rooms.
"So that's how you came across the Black Rock,"
she called back.
"You made a deal for it."
"No," said Kel. "I made a mistake. One I intend to fix if I can find the damn thing."
He slammed a drawer shut in frustration.
"Careful," said a gruff voice in Arnesian. "You might break something."
Kel spun to find the shop's owner standing there, shoulder tipped against a wardrobe, looking vaguely bemused.
"Fletcher," said Kel. "How did you get in?" asked Fletcher.
Kel forced himself to shrug as he shot a glance toward Lila, who'd had the good sense to stay in the hallway and out of sight.
"I guess your ward's wearing thin." Fletcher crossed his arms. "I doubt that."
Kel stole a second glance toward Lila, but she was no longer in the hall. A spike of panic ran through him, one that worsened a moment later when she reappeared behind Fletcher. She moved with silent steps, a knife glittering in one hand.
"Tark,"
said Fletcher, lifting his hand beside his head.
"Your friend is very rude."
As he said it, Lila froze mid-stride. The strain showed in her face as she tried to fight the invisible force holding her in place, but it was no use. Fletcher had the rare and dangerous ability to control bones, and therefore bodies. It was an ability that had earned him the binding scars he was so proud of breaking. Lila, for one, seemed unimpressed. She muttered some very violent things, and Fletcher splayed his fingers. Kel heard a sound like cracking ice, and Lila let out a stifled cry, the knife tumbling from her fingers.
"I thought you prefer to work alone," said Fletcher conversationally. "Let her go," ordered Kel. "Are you going to make me, Antari?"
Kel's fingers curled into fists. The shop was warded a dozen ways against intruders and thieves and, with Kel's luck, anyone who meant Fletcher harm. But the shop owner himself gave a low chuckle and dropped his hand, and Lila went stumbling to her hands and knees, clutching her wrist and swearing vehemently.
"Anesh," he said casually, "what brings you back to my humble shop?"
"I gave you something once," said Kel. "I'd like to borrow it." Fletcher gave a derisive snort.
"I am not in the business of borrowers."
"I'll buy it, then."
"And if it's not for sale?"
Kel forced himself to smile.
"You of all people know," he said, "that everything is for sale."
Fletcher parroted the smile, cold and dry.
"I won't sell it to you, but I might sell it to her.
His gaze glanced to Lila, who had gotten to her feet and retreated to the nearest wall to lurk and curse.
For the right price.
She doesn't speak Arnesian, said Kell. She hasn't the faintest idea what you're saying.
Oh?
Fletcher grabbed his crotch.
I bet I can make her understand, he said, shaking himself in her direction.
Lila's eyes narrowed.
Burn in hell, you fu—
I wouldn't bother with her, cut in Kell. She bites.
Fletcher sighed and shook his head.
What kind of trouble are you in, Master Kell?
None.
You must be in some to come here.
And besides,
said Fletcher, smile sharpening,
they don't put your face up on the boards for nothing.
Kell's eyes flicked to the scrying board on the wall, the one that had been painted with his face for the last hour. And then he paled. The circle at the bottom, the one that said, if seen, touch here, was pulsing bright green.
What have you done? Growled Kell.
Fletcher only smiled.
No hard feelings, he said darkly.
Right before the shop doors burst open, and the Royal Guard poured in. 5. Kell had only an instant to arrange his features, to force panic into composure before the guards were there, 5 in all, filling up the room with movement and noise. He couldn't run. There was nowhere to run to, and he didn't want to hurt them, and Lila... Well, he had no idea where Lila was. One moment she'd been right there against the wall, and the next she'd vanished. Though Kell had seen her fingers go into the pocket of her coat the instant before she disappeared, and he could feel the subtle hum of the stone's magic in the air, the way Holland must have felt it at the Ruby Fields. Kell forced himself to stay still, to feign calm, even though his heart was racing in his chest. He tried to remind himself that he wasn't a criminal, that the royals were likely only worried by his disappearance. He hadn't done anything wrong, not in the eyes of the crown, not that they knew of. Unless in his absence Ryad told the king and queen of his transgressions. He wouldn't. Kell hoped he wouldn't, but even if he had, Kell was Antari, a member of the royal family, someone to be respected, even feared. He coated himself in that knowledge as he leaned back lazily, almost arrogantly, against the table behind him. When the members of the royal guard saw him standing there, alive and unconcerned, confusion spread across their features. Had they expected a body? A brawl? Half went to kneel and half brought hands to rest on the hilts of their swords, and one stood there, frowning, in the middle.
Ellis, said Kell, nodding at the head of the royal guard.
Master Kell, said Ellis, stepping forward. Are you well?
Of course.
Ellis fidgeted.
We've been worried about you. The whole palace has been...
I didn't mean to worry anyone, he said, considering the guard around him. As you can see, I'm perfectly all right.
Ellis looked around, then back at Kell.
It's just, sir, when you did not return from your errand abroad...
I was delayed, said Kell, hoping that would quell the questions.
Ellis frowned.
Did you not see the signs? They're posted everywhere.
I only just returned.
Then, forgive me,
countered Ellis, gesturing to the shop.
But what are you doing here?
Fletcher frowned. Though he spoke only Arnesian, he clearly understood the royal tongue well enough to know he was being insulted. Kell forced a thin smile.
Shopping for Rye's present.
A nervous laugh passed through the guard.
You'll come with us, then?
Asked Ellis, and Kell understood the words that went unsaid. Without a fight.
Of course,
said Kell, rising to his full height and smoothing his jacket. The guards looked relieved. Kell's mind spun as he turned to Fletcher and thanked him for his help.
Mas Maris,
answered the shop's owner darkly. My pleasure,
Just doing my civic duty.
I'll be back, said Cal in English, which garnered a raised brow from the royal guard.
As soon as I'm through, to find what I was looking for.
The words were directed at Lila. He could still feel her in the room, feel the stone even as it hit her. It whispered to him.
Sir,
said Ellis, gesturing to the door.
After you.
Kel nodded and followed him out. The moment she heard the guards burst in, Lila had the good sense to close her hand over the stone and say, Conceal me! And the stone had obeyed once more. She'd felt a flutter up her arm just beneath her skin. A lovely sensation. Had it felt that nice the last time she'd used the talisman? And then the veil had settled over her again and she was gone. Just as before, she could see herself, but no one else could see her. Not the guards, not Fletcher, not even Kel, whose two-toned eyes levelled on her but seemed to make out only the place she'd been and not the place she was. But though he could not see her, she could see him, and in his face she read a flicker of worry, disguised by his voice but not his posture, and under it a warning, threaded through the false calm of his words. Stay, it seemed to urge, even before he said the words, lobbed at the room but clearly meant for her. So she stayed, and waited, and watched as Kel and four of the five members of the guard poured out into the street. Watched as a single guard hung back, his face hidden beneath the lowered visor of his helmet. Fletcher was saying something to him, gesturing at his palm in the universal sign for payment. The guard nodded, and his hand went to his belt as Fletcher turned to watch Kel through the window. Lila saw it coming. Fletcher never did. Instead of reaching for a purse, the guard went for a blade. The metal glinted once in the shop's low light, and then it was under Fletcher's chin, drawing a silent red line across his throat. A closed carriage pulled by royal white horses, gold and red ribbons still woven through their manes from the earlier parade, was watching for Kel in front of the shop. As Kel made his way to it, he shrugged out of his coat and turned it left to right, sliding his arms back into the now red sleeves of his royal attire. His thoughts spun over what to tell the king and queen. Not the truth, of course. But the king himself had a white London token, an ornament that sat on a shelf in his private chamber, and if Kel could get it and get back to Lila and the stone... Lila and the stone loose in the city, it was a troubling thought. But hopefully she would stay put, just a little while. Stay out of trouble. Ellis walked a half-step behind Kel, three more guards trailing in his wake. The last had stayed behind to talk to Fletcher and most likely settle the matter of the reward. Though Kel was fairly sure Fletcher hated him enough to turn him in even without the added prospect of money. Down the river toward the palace, the day celebrations were dying down. No, not dying, shifting to make way for the evening's festivities. The music had softened, and the crowds along the docks and up the market stretch had thinned, migrating to the city's various pubs and inns to continue toasting Rye's name.
"Come, sir,"
said Ellis, holding the carriage door open for him. Instead of seats that faced each other, this carriage had two sets of benches, both facing forward. Two of the guards took the seat behind, and one went up to sit with the driver, while Ellis slid onto the front bench beside Kel and pulled the carriage door closed.
"Let's get you home."
Kel's chest ached at the thought of it. He had tried not to let himself think of home, of how badly he wanted to be there, not since the stone... and the grim task of its disposal had fallen to him. Now all he wanted to see was Rye, to embrace him one last time, and he was secretly glad of the chance. He let out a shaky breath and sank back onto the bench as Ellis drew the carriage curtains.
"I'm sorry about this, sir,"
he said, and Kel was about to ask what for when a hand clamped a cloth over his mouth and his lungs filled with something bitter and sweet. He tried to wrench free, but armoured gloves closed over his wrists and held him back against the bench. And within moments, everything went dark. Lila sucked in a breath, unheard beneath the veil, as the guard let go of Fletcher's shoulder and he fell forward, thudding in a lifeless mass against the worn floorboards of the shop. The guard stood there unfazed by the murder and seemingly oblivious to the fact he was now splattered with someone else's blood. He surveyed the room, his gaze drifting past her, but through the slot in his helmet, Lila thought she saw an odd shimmer in his eyes. Something like magic. Satisfied that there was no one else to dispose of, the guard returned his blade to its sheath, turned on his heel, and left the shop. A dull bell followed him out, and a few minutes later, Lila heard a carriage shudder to life and rumble away down the street. Fletcher's body lay sprawled on the floor of his shop, blood soaking through his wiry blonde hair and staining the boards beneath his chest. His smug expression was gone, replaced by surprise, the emotion preserved by death like an insect in amber. His eyes were open and empty, but something pale had tumbled from his shirt pocket and was now caught between his body and the floor. Something that looked very much like a white rook. Lila looked around to make sure she was alone, then did away with the concealment spell. It was easy enough undoing the magic, but letting go of the stone itself proved considerably more difficult. It took her a long moment, and when she finally managed to pull free and drop the talisman back into her pocket, the whole room tilted. A shudder passed through her, stealing warmth and something more. In the magic's wake, she felt empty. Lila was used to hunger, but the stone left her feeling starved in a bone-deep way. Hollow. Bloody rock, she thought, tucking the toe of her boot under Fletcher's dead shoulder and turning him over, his blank stare now directed up at the ceiling and at her. She knelt, careful to avoid the spreading red slick as she picked up the blood-flecked chess piece. Lila swore with relief and straightened, weighing it appraisingly. At first glance it looked rather ordinary, and yet when she curled her fingers around the stone, or bone, or whatever it was carved out of, she could almost feel the difference between its energy and that of the London around her. It was subtle, and perhaps she was imagining it, but the rook felt like a draught in a warm room, just cold enough to seem out of place. She shrugged off the sensation and tucked the chess piece into her boot. She didn't know how magic worked, but it didn't seem a wise idea to keep the two talismans close together, not until they were needed, and she wasn't touching the thieving little rock again unless she absolutely had to. She wiped Fletcher's blood off on her pants. All things considered, Lila was feeling rather accomplished. After all, she had the Black London Stone and the White London Token. Now all she needed was Kell. Lila turned toward the door and hesitated. He told her to stay put, but as she looked down at Fletcher's fresh corpse, she feared he'd walked into trouble of his own. She'd been in Red London only a day, but it didn't seem like the place where royal guards went around slitting people's throats. Maybe Kell would be fine, but if he wasn't? Her gut said to go, and years of stealing to survive had taught her to listen when it spoke. Besides, she reasoned, no one in the city was looking for her. Lila made for the door, and she was almost to it when she saw the knife again, the one she'd been so keen on, sitting on top of the chest where she'd left it. Kell had warned her against thieving in the shop, but the owner was dead, and it was just sitting there, unappreciated. She took it up and ran a finger gingerly along the blade. It really was a lovely knife. She eyed the door, wondering if the wards protecting the shop from thieves had died with their maker. Might as well test it. Carefully she opened the door, set the weapon on the floor, and used the toe of her boot to kick the knife over the threshold. She cringed, waiting for the backlash. A current of energy, a wave